Good afternoon. My name is Eric Heath. I am the Senior Policy Counsel for the Northeast Midwest Institute's Mississippi River Basin Program. I want to thank you all for coming to what I'm sure will be a very informative briefing on Asian carp management and control in the Ohio River and Upper Mississippi River Basins, in collaboration with our colleagues at the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resources Association, or MICRA. I also want to thank Congressman Mike Kelly and Congressman Rick Nolan and their respective staffs for helping us put this briefing together. We couldn't have done this without their support. Today, you'll be hearing from Greg Conover. He's MICRA's coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he's going to give us an introduction on Asian carp management and control in the Mississippi River Basin. Next, you'll hear from Nick Frohenauer. He's the Upper Mississippi Invasive Carp Representative for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and he will be discussing the Upper Mississippi River Invasive Carp Partnership. Next, you'll hear from Ron Brooks. He's the Director of the Fisheries Division for the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, and he'll be discussing the Ohio River Basin Asian Carp Partnership. Then you'll hear from Aaron Wolt. He is the Deputy of ARD Fisheries for the Midwest Region for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and he will be discussing the Asian carp deterrent efforts in the Ohio River and Upper Mississippi River. And finally, Bill Taylor will be representing the sport fishing industry in the private sector. He is the Senior Director of Tournament Operations for Fishing League Worldwide, and he's going to discuss the impact of Asian carp on recreational fishing tournaments and associated economies. After the panelists speak, we'll have some brief question and answers, so if you have questions, please save them till then. And thank you all for coming. Now I'll turn it over to Greg and the rest of the panelists.
Thank you for that introduction, Eric. Flip through a couple slides here. Okay. So good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. I'm going to start our presentation off today by just hitting on a few highlights to give you some background and an introduction to Asian carp management and control efforts in the Mississippi River Basin. And I'd like to start by talking about the National Asian Carp Management and Control Plan. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service led the development of this collaborative plan in the mid-2000s with a partnership of more than 70 stakeholders and partners from other federal agencies, state agencies, academia, industry, and other non-governmental partners. This partnership worked to develop a collaborative, very comprehensive plan to address the myriad aspects of Asian carp prevention and control at a national level. That plan was approved in 2007 by the National Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force for implementation. And since then, the national plan has really been the foundation for the development of regional sub-basin, what you'll hear called frameworks or action plans. Those frameworks and action plans are the way that regional partnerships, state partnerships, multi-agency partnerships are working together to implement the national plan at a regional or a local level. And you'll hear more about that from our other speakers coming up. Really, the first major step forward for management and control, Asian carp management and control in the Mississippi River Basin came with the reauthorization of WRDA in 2014, and in particular, Section 1039, which gave direction to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to lead multi-agency efforts in the Upper Mississippi River and the Ohio River basins to slow the spread of Asian carp within those waters. The Act also directed the Fish and Wildlife Service to submit an annual report to Congress each year that highlighted or summarized the actions that were taken in those two parts of the Mississippi River Basin, as well as the expenditures of state and federal agencies to address Asian carp in those waters. Now, when the Fish and Wildlife Service reached out to the states to talk about collaborative management and control efforts in the Upper Mississippi and Ohio River basins, the states in those sub-basins specifically asked the Fish and Wildlife Service to work with the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association, or MICRA, because there was already a partnership and a structure in place for basin-wide coordination. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is working closely with MICRA with the states through MICRA. We're not advancing. Yeah, Thank you. Okay, so following the reauthorization of order in 2014, beginning in 2015, Congress appropriated funding, base agency funding, to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for Asian carp actions outside of the Great Lakes. And you can see on the table on the upper right there, shows the funding, how that has increased for the Fish and Wildlife Service since 2015. And the service uses that funding. It passes through a large portion of that funding to the states in the form of grants or agreements to help the states in those multi-agency partnerships implement Asian carp, their highest priority Asian carp actions in the Upper Mississippi and Ohio River basins for implementing their frameworks. And you can see as well that the funding for both the service and the funding going out to those state partnerships has increased steadily each year and has enabled the partnerships to do more and more actions and have better effort out on the water to implement their frameworks and accomplish prevention and control efforts. MICRA works with the states each year in these different partnerships in the Upper Mississippi River and Ohio River basins, but also in the Lower Mississippi River and the Missouri River basin, so that we can look at the Mississippi River basin as a whole and identify priority actions and coordinate actions within those different sub-basins. For as far as the Upper Mississippi River and Ohio River basins go, they work together to identify their highest priority collaborative projects going into each year. And those are pulled together in a document that's called the Monitoring Response Plan. And that plan is put online each year on www.asiancarp.us. It looks like it's strictly a Great Lakes website. It's ACRCC. But also included in there is work that's going on in the Mississippi River Basin. So you can find the Monitoring Response Plan for more details, and as well as annual interim summary reports each year that explain the accomplishments for that funding each year. And then the last thing I would point out is that both MICRA and the Fish and Wildlife Service work to make sure that we have coordination between those sub-basin efforts, but then also with the Great Lakes efforts, so that we can collaborate and leverage as much as possible. And with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Nick, who will give you more information on the Upper Mississippi River Basin efforts.
Thank you for having me here today to update you on the Asian carp work occurring in the Upper Mississippi River. I work for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, but I'm here today as a representative for the UMR Asian Carp Work Group that is a collaboration of the five UMR states, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Missouri, and the collaborating federal agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Geological Survey, National Park Service, and the Army Corps of Engineers. This work group came together in 2012 and was more formalized in 2014 after the passage of WERDA that Greg talked about earlier. Federal aid combined with state contributions has helped in the development of an Upper Mississippi River control and prevention strategy and the early stages of implementation. Funding has been used and is currently being used for the detection and assessment work that has contributed greatly to our understanding of Asian carp populations in the Upper Mississippi River. This group has used this information to formulate a strategy based on focusing efforts on a management zone. The objective being preventing fish from moving into areas where they are not yet established, an upstream boundary, and also preventing fish from moving from well-established dense populations into this area. Then control actions can be focused on this much smaller area. In essence, we don't have to spread all our efforts over a big geographic area. In the Mississippi, we are fortunate enough to have the lock and dam systems. This makes an potential ideal spot to put in deterrence measures for that upstream and downstream boundary. But not all lock and dams are created equal. So the UMR work group took our knowledge of each individual lock and dam system and combine that with our knowledge of the current populations out there and determine that the locations of Lock and Dam 14 and 15 would make a good upstream boundary and Lock and Dam 19 would make a good downstream boundary. Then an integrated pest management or multi-tool approach will be applied to this zone. Past funding has been used to determine the best locations and suitable technologies for deterrence measures at the upper and lower boundaries. In a soon-to-be-released UMR deterrence strategy report, the group recommended testing acoustic technology as a deterrent measure in locked chambers, while further exploring options for the dam gates, like flow modifications. Concurrent with this work on deterrence, removal efforts have been implemented in this zone. Funding has been used to ramp up a commercial fishing program that to date has taken out hundreds of thousands of pounds in this area. Additionally, partners led by the Western Illinois University are working on specific techniques to remove large quantities of carp in a short time period. Lastly, the group continues to explore additional actions to further reduce populations in the management zone. This could include the strategic release of the microparticle being developed by the USGS, and also habitat projects that could be used to concentrate Asian carp for capture and mass removal. The UMR work group greatly appreciates the funding received to date. The funding that has been used for the evaluation work, the commercial harvest, and the exploration of deterrence has helped move us in the right direction. But as we look forward and as we work out solutions, we're going to need a larger investment. Implementation of deterrence projects and applying commercial fishermen at the level that we need to help reduce and control the population of Asian carp on the Mississippi River is going to take a much larger investment. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Ron Brooks, who will talk about the Ohio River.
Thank you for being here today. This is going to be short and sweet, so bear with me. We're going to go about 10,000 miles an hour. Basically, I'm representing the Ohio River folks who are Kentucky, Ohio to some extent, West Virginia and Indiana, who are putting most of the effort into it, along with Pennsylvania, who's also doing a bit of work here. There it is. All right. So when you look at the map here, what you're going to see is a lot of colors. On the upper left-hand side, you can see we're doing the same kind of monitoring and control efforts and telemetry efforts as what they're doing on the upper Mississippi River Basin. But when we got 600 miles to work with, we had to be kind of particular on what we do where. So we really kind of categorize what we're doing based on the densities of fish and the characteristics of the fish in each of these sections that you're seeing in color. For instance, on the very upper part of the right-hand corner, you're seeing a eDNA. That's a method where people can go in and take water samples. They do DNA on those water samples, and sometimes if there's Asian carp in the area, they'll get a positive hit. In those cases, Pennsylvania would go out and sample to verify that those positive hits are true. In the years that we've been doing this since 2013, I think they've had like one positive response where they've had to go out and try to verify that. So what we're saying here is that there's almost no fish above that green area. There's probably a few wandering around, nothing of danger. In the green area, you notice it says presence of adults. Well, there's very, very few adults in there for the most part. And so what we do in that green area mostly is basically monitor the fish communities. We don't go out and do a lot of effort in control and removal. Those green areas, by the way, start in Greenup Pool, which is at the very northeast part of Kentucky, and move really on up into West Virginia and Ohio. The yellow areas are really mostly Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana shared. Basically, depending upon how far downriver you go, there's three pools in there. There's the Meldaw Pool next to the green. You see a little triangle in the Meldaw Pool. That signifies a sample that was made in, I think it was 2015, by Osanko. They actually had some larval Asian carp in that sample. We were not able to define what species it was. It could have been grass carp, it could have been big head, or it could have been the silvers. But beyond that, we've never had any larval samples occur. But what we do see in the very few fish we get in the Meldal pool there, every now and then we'll see a spawning patch. When the Asian carp spawn, they rub and they ended up providing patches, sort of sore-like marks on their body, and we can use those to tell whether or not they're trying to at least go through the motions. When you go on further down to the Markland pool, which is kind of the part there that kind of humps up in the middle there with the yellow, you start seeing more Asian carp finally. We can expect to go out in that area and actually catch Asian carp, and therefore we do a smaller amount of monitoring from there on down and do a lot more what we call control removal. We actually go out and target Asian carp where we know they're going to be where they spend a lot of their time through telemetry efforts. And so a lot more work is put into making sure we attain our goals of preventing these things from becoming reproductively established up the river. When you get down to Bacalpin, right above the star there, there's really quite a few fish in that pool, so we do a lot of work in that area. The red part there is pretty much from there all the way down the Ohio River, really. Could be red because there's tons and tons of Asian carp in there. They have a lot of places they can spawn successfully, and they do. We've got larval reports that are larval samples that have been positive for Asian carp. And it's kind of a no-brainer when you look at how many fish are in there anyway. So down there, we haven't done a lot with that. There's a Falls of the Ohio at Louisville where that star is sitting at McAlpin Lock and Dam, and it's really been a pinch point for Asian carp in terms of their ability to get beyond that point. And so what we are going to start doing in 2018, and what we actually started doing in 2017 a little more, is we're going to do contract fishing to fish the numbers down right below the dam there. What that'll do for you is basically reduce what we call propagule pressure, and that is the impetus for fish to want to move upriver to find better feed sources. So we're going to be doing a lot of that this year. We got some funding to finally do that, and we're kind of excited about that. So all in all, the take-home message of all of our sampling that we've been doing for the last several years is, so far it looks like we've been successful in stopping these things from moving upriver in terms of having recruiting populations above where that star is in Louisville, which is the goal of this project, really. With this contract fishing, we hope what will happen is eventually that green part of the map you see will be migrating down to where the green actually meets the red. And if we get a successful contract fishing effort and commercial fishing effort in the Cannelton Pool, we certainly believe we can get there. The stars you're seeing are the barrier potential or priority sites. The McAlpin is one of those priority sites in Louisville there. We're next to the yellow and red. If the funds were to come through and the system works, that'd be one of the priority areas. And, of course, further up above our Seabird and the Racine Lock and Dam, that would also be a priority. The star on the very lower left there is the Barkley Dam, where some of the tests are going to be taking place with the acoustic deterrent system, which Aaron's going to talk about. I'll let that go to him. That circle is circling Kentucky and Barkley Lakes. You know, we've been doing work. We have a staff out there of six, three biologists, three technicians that have been working in those lakes to kind of get an assessment of where we are, where those lakes are in terms of density and the effects they're having on the native species in those lakes. But we've also done a lot with commercial fishing. We have finally landed three processing companies that are in Western Kentucky right now. The problem is they're not meeting their demand in terms of being able to get the fish out of the water enough for them to meet their market demand. And so we've started a new program called the Fish House, where my department is putting $4 million into a system that will increase, incentivize commercial fishermen. It will help the processors in terms of transportation of the fish from the lakes to the processors. There's all kinds of perks that I don't have time to go into, but the bottom line is we're going to see a great increase in harvest of Asian carp. You see kind of an exponential line there right now, that blue line as far as the millions of pounds coming out. We expect to double that in the next year if this program works and actually go much further than that in all Kentucky waters. And also we're going to be working with the USGS on various experimental gears as well. And really my time's out now. And next, Aaron, you want to talk about the barrier systems?
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming, and thanks to the panel also for being here, and to some of our valued state partners like Illinois who are here as well, too. Thanks, guys, for coming. So everyone can hear me, right? Everyone in the back? Okay, great. So as Ron said, I'm going to talk a little bit about acoustic deterrence in the Ohio River and Upper Mississippi River Basin. And I know it's hard to see on the screen, but I'll kind of take you through it. Both bighead and silver carp are sensitive to underwater sounds and pressure. As evidenced by that picture on the bottom of the slide, those are silver carp jumping as they're being disturbed by a boat motor. The bighead don't jump like that, but the silvers certainly do. So what we know is that, you know, different types of acoustic deterrence signals and arrays are being tested right now, whether it's at universities or private companies or government agencies are being tested on Asian carps in both laboratory and pond settings. Really what you can do is you can almost tune the sound a little bit to see what sounds and what pressures affect the fish the most. So that's been going on now for several years. And the most effective to date appears to be what's called a bioacoustic fish fence, also is known as a BAF. And they call it a BAF because that's easier to say than bioacoustic fish fence. But that combines both sound and compressed air or bubbles to help deter silver and bighead carp from moving by. Some of them also have lights on them, so you get sound, bubbles, lights. That's the one that you've heard people probably call the disco barrier because it's got all those different things going on. Anyway, you combine those things and it'll deter these fish from moving. So these things are being tested in a lab and in some small-scale field tests, but what's left is to do an implementation of a large-scale kind of proof-of-concept field test, which is what we're planning in conjunction with our state partners in 2019 and hopefully 2020 in both the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Mississippi River Basin, looking at strategic passage points or pinch points on the rivers, and we're selecting these pinch points in consultation with our partners. We're not doing this in a vacuum. It's a group of us together trying to pick those points. And like I said, right now this shows great promise in the lab and some small-scale field tests, but the question is, how does this work in a big river system? So what we're going to do, using part of the services budget in our FY18 appropriation from Congress, we were directed to use a portion of funds to do a couple things. One was to implement deterrence, which is what we're talking about. Another was to encourage and to actually send money to the states to use directed contract commercial fishing to remove fish, which Ron had talked about, and then also to address some grass carp issues in Western Lake Erie with our state partners there. But we're going to be using, like I said, those funds also for deterrence, and we're looking at areas, again, in the Upper Miss and the Ohio River. So we've identified a couple test site locations, and these are, again, recommendations from our partners, and it's a little hard to see on the map, but there's two sites, and Ron already pointed, it's even hard for me to see, but there's one, the star down here, star right there, is Barkley Lock and Dam in Grand Rivers, Kentucky. And the star right there for the next potential site is Lock and Dam 19 in Keokuk, Iowa. So what we're hoping to do with these sites is we're hoping to put some test site locations in there to implement and look at a large-scale field test of these bioacoustic fish fences. We've picked these locations because they have kind of a high head on these barriers, so that the fish can really only pass through the lock chamber. They're not going over the dam at high water. They're not going around it. The only path through is the lock chamber, which is where we can implement one of these bioacoustic fish fences. They're in areas that have established populations of Asian carp, and they're places that have infrastructure where we can either attach monitoring devices or conduct monitoring, or there's already those structures there that we can do monitoring from. That's why we picked these two locations as strategic for now. When I say we're monitoring and doing these field tests, these are tests, these are field evaluations, and what we're looking at is we're looking at what do these systems do to Asian carp, but also what do they do to other native species? Do they stop other native species from moving? We're looking at what do they do to other resource users, like boaters and anglers and fishermen, to see if they have any impacts there. And we're also looking at what impact these systems could have on industry that use both of these areas. Just to drill down a little bit into the two specific areas, Barkley Lock and Dam, again in Grand Rivers, Kentucky, is our Ohio River Basin test site. Our plan there is to deploy some equipment, and they'll sit right on the riverbed. And it's going to be in the lock chamber. So this is an aerial picture of the area. Here's the lock chamber right here. We try to put that BAF right across that lock chamber. The equipment would sit on the bottom. Barges and other craft would be able to pass right over the system. depending on how it's designed and how it works out, we might have an option to trap and remove carp that might be, you know, somehow deterred behind this. It all depends on how the system works once it's installed to see if that will be an option. Installation is going to be done so that it will minimize navigation traffic impacts. So all any equipment that sits on the bottom will sit below the elevation of the miter sill, so that nothing should impact the system, and we shouldn't get in trouble with hitting any vessels that are passing over. It's going to be a leased system that's coming from a company called Fish Guidance Systems, who we've been working with. We've been working with them and also the University of Minnesota to do some of this testing. The hope is to have this in 2019 and to do a 2 to 3 year test at this site. The second site where we're considering doing this along with our partners is Lock and Dam 19. This would be our Upper Mississippi River Basin test site. And the work on this has been a collaboration with the Fish and Wildlife Service, USGS, the Army Corps of Engineers, Iowa DNR, and Illinois DNR. And the hope here is to conduct the feasibility study for 2 to 3 years of this BAF system starting in 2020. Now, I will tell everyone, just to be in the spirit of total honesty and transparency, that not all parties agree that this is the perfect location in the Upper Mississippi River to put this system. We're still working through that consultative process with our partners. There's a chance that it could be at Lock and Dam 19. There's also a chance it could be somewhere else in the system. So we're continuing to work through that to make sure that we address any concerns that any of the partner agencies might have about that location. So I just want to put that out there. Again, deterrent technology in this site will be very similar to what we're doing over at Kentucky Lake, but it'll be a little bit different. The sound might be tuned a little bit differently, so we have a little bit of a comparison test. We're collecting some baseline site data this year, doing some sound modeling to kind of tune that sound a little bit, and hopefully, if this is a year later than the Ohio River Basin site, we can take what we learned from Kentucky and apply it to help us fine-tune this system here as well, which again, we're hoping will start in 2020. And with that, I will turn it over to Bill Taylor of FLW to bring us home for the briefing. Bill?
Okay, hi, I'm Bill Taylor, Senior Tournament Director of Operations at FLW. FLW stands for Fishing League Worldwide. We're located in Benton, Kentucky, Marshall County there, right on the borders of Kentucky Lake. I'm not only a tournament official, but I'm a recreational fisherman. I fish the waters that we've discussed here today from the upper Mississippi all the way to Pittsburgh on the Ohio. I fished every lake on the Tennessee River, and I fished most of the tributaries of the Ohio between Paducah, Kentucky, and Cincinnati. So I feel like that I've got a lot of knowledge of the waterways through there, but most importantly, I see it from not only a company aspect, but I see it from an angler that first saw. My first example was in 2007, I saw the first Asian specimen that I was aware of. Didn't know what it was. But in the last few years, we recognize the fact that the numbers have increased dramatically. And with that comes some issues with tourism. They don't know what to expect when they go on the water. It affects our tournament operations. Our numbers are down, especially on the Tennessee River system. The upper Mississippi at this time, our numbers in tournaments are maintaining their own averages. They may be down a percent or two, but on the Tennessee River and the Ohio River system, our tournament angler numbers are down, and I'm talking about participation, is down nearly 20%. With that comes the fear of what the effect it's going to have with our tourism in those areas. I come from a county that depends on Kentucky Lake, plain and simple. Our dollars and our income from that county, along with every community along the Tennessee River, the Cumberland River, most of the ones up the Ohio, depend on those waterways for tourism. For example, I was on the waters during the 4th of July weekend, and I could have launched on any launch ramp on either lake. The launch ramps with vehicles were nearly empty. the tourism had failed to a point where the fishermen are not coming. The tourists are coming down to have homes on the lake. However, they're not utilizing the resources that are there. You used to see a lot of water skiing, a lot of jet skiing, a lot of just tubing, as we'll call it, a lot of just swimming. Those activities have fell off dramatically. And the fishing itself has, maybe we're in a cycle, I'm not sure. Ron Brooks and I have talked about it. We don't know if it's because of the habitat that the Asian species are taking, and whether it's affecting the movement and the location of our sport fish. We're not 100% sure, but we know that the catches for the black bass is down. Okay, other species, the catches are still maintaining their numbers. Okay, the one thing that we worries us as tournament fishermen, should we begin to lose the bait fish. And that starts with everything from the shad populations and any fish that feeds on the plankton, and that's what the Asians utilize for their food supplies. So, with that being said, our tourism rates there, along with decline in numbers in our tournament anglers, the dollars spent in the recreational fishing, has fallen off to the point now that our company has just really gotten involved with this situation the last couple of years. Now, you're going to be hearing a lot more voices from a lot of other different people that utilize these fisheries. And I'm talking about from Pittsburgh all the way up to La Crosse, Wisconsin, all the way to New Orleans. Those people now are aware of the situation with the Asian species that are in those waters. The sheer numbers, if you're not there to see those sheer numbers, you would not believe it. For an example, on a clear day or on a day where there's low wind, you may see an area that's a mile or 2 miles long out offshore of the lakes, on the shale beds, and on those bars, sheer thousands, not thousands, but millions of Asian carp. You can see them as far as the eye can see. And until you look at that situation, you don't understand just exactly what the impact is to those fisheries. Now, I did an event on Lake St. Clair that proved to be one of the best fishing tournaments that I've ever been a part of. Record catches. The last thing we would want, as not only a recreational angler or a biologist or just a person utilizing those lakes, is to let this stuff get as far up into the Great Lakes systems. And I know there's work that's been done, tremendous amount of work being done. I admire Ron Brooks and his team, the chairman on this panel. It's amazing to sit and do lunch with these guys and know exactly what they're going through over the past 7 or 10, up to 10 years. They've been working on this. Again, the involvement in the general public has just begun. We've got a meeting in Eddyville, Kentucky, Friday evening. There'll probably be 4,000 to 5,000 people there. And those are anglers, they're property owners, the people that run businesses there, they're coming out. I'm going to say, I know Senator McConnell there from Kentucky, whom I'm very proud of. I voted for, by the way. Every election he's run for is supporting some things that we need there. The one thing we need are resources, obviously, each one of these states. And I just know this. I'm 71 years old tomorrow, but I hope and pray that my grandkids and our high school anglers and our college people that are fishing today and growing our outdoor sport, I hope that we can put these Asians under control. And I think that the plan that this group right here has to control that through commercial fishing and taking out the numbers of those fish, I think that we'll all be for the better off. And again, I appreciate everyone coming out. I appreciate the opportunity to be on this panel. It means a lot to our company. It means a lot to me. And I certainly hope and pray that you guys and ladies take into consideration that the issue amongst these Asian species is huge. And I guess we'll turn it over now if there's questions, Ron and Greg. So if you've got any questions, just feel free to you handle the questions. Great.
I think Eric's going to do that.
Okay, Eric.
Before we do questions, I just wanted to acknowledge that we had the other federal partners that MICRA works with and the Fish and Wildlife Service works with. So U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is here, USGS is here, and Eric, as you pointed out, the Elementary is here as well. Just want to point out we have others here that can participate in the question.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Greg. We'll now open up for questions. We've still got about 15, 20 minutes. I'll just ask that whoever answers a question, please pass the recorder down with you so we get that on the audio recording. We'll have this posted on our website afterwards, and we'll email the materials and the recording to all attendees in case you have people in your office who are interested in hearing the recording or seeing the slides. So with that, I'll open up for questions. Thank you all for coming.
Sure. So contract fishing at the state level, when you contract with the state, those fish aren't able to be sold that the contract fishermen catch. Much cheaper way to go really is a cheap subsidy, a 5 cents a pound subsidy. You know, give them some incentives like free ice machine that we've got now that they can get free ice. Transportation system like Fish and Wildlife is doing right now. Those kind of incentives for the commercial industry and let the commercial industry take off. That's going to be our approach. And again, we are signing contracts on that fish house either this week or next. So we're actually finally going to get it off the ground. This has been in planning for 3 years. And so that's the approach that we take. There is a place for contract fishing, like what I was showing you on McAlpin there around Louisville, because there's not an established commercial fishing effort there yet. What I hope to do with that funding and contract fishing is to provide information to the commercial folks that, you know, we are helping to set up a transportation system between there and the processors. All they got to do is go out and get the fish. We'll meet them at the boat ramps. But we have to show them that there's a lot of fish in there that they can profit from. And so that's kind of the approach we're taking. So it's interesting because initially it was just a foreign market when our first processor came in. She's a Chinese American. She exported poultry and beef from L.A. and she heard about the Asian carp problem. Contacted me. We got together and we got her talking with some state folks. And now she started out exporting to Asian carp to China. As it turned out, China is very difficult to work with, even with somebody who has good connections there. And so right now, she does about 7% of her business in China. A lot of her business goes to Israel and other places in that area. And the rest of it is domestic. There is actually a potential for increased domestic market with the ethnic populations in this country. For instance, if we could get them the fish, New York had, there's one business in New York that was asking for 30 million pounds a year. The point is, we can't get the fish that the markets need right now, which is what we have to do right now is we have to get the number of commercial fishing fishermen up in Kentucky, and we have to get more efficient gears, of which we're working with the USGS on that this year and other partners. And we got to combine all that effort to show folks that we can get those fish out of the water. Even if we harvest more than what the market can take initially, it won't take long for people to hear that these excess fish are coming out. They're going to contact us and ask for fish. We've had requests from people all over the world in terms of needing fish and wanting to know how we could work with them to get them fish. So it's just a matter of logistics. It's a matter of marketing. But more than anything right now, it's a matter of getting the fishing effort on the water.
Kevin?
Sure. I'll just speak very quickly to that on AsianCarp.us. We do have a economic business plan approach for Asian carp posted, and that talks really broadly exactly what Ron is saying. It has to be a regional approach. We've got a pilot project we're trying to do in Illinois on the Illinois River, but it's something that we do want it to grow. It does address logistics, safety, make sure the fish, the quality control issues. So you have more logistical problems the farther you take it from the U.S.
I want to add one more thing. I think at one of the briefings early on that we did here, or at least in this area, the question always comes up as to what do you think about incentivizing an industry who are going to want to perpetuate Asian carp in order to keep that industry alive? Well, I think the Asian carp expansion and the fact that they can be so prolific and they've shown how prolific they can be took care of that answer. There are no other ways of getting Asian carp out in numbers enough to affect their populations. In certain areas, like a reservoir or certain pools on what we call the leading edge, we can certainly control them and fish them down. But for instance, if we were successful in commercial fishing Kentucky and Barkley enough to get rid of all the Asian carp in there, the commercial fishermen have thousands and thousands of miles of tributaries, small rivers, big rivers, where these things are stacked like they are on the Illinois River and in the tailwaters of the Kentucky and Barkley dams. So it's not like we're ever going to put the commercial industry out of business, and it's not like they got to start stocking them somewhere intentionally to perpetuate their supply. It's going to be way beyond our lifetimes before an industry could grow that much to have an effect on the number of fish throughout the basin. So that's, in my mind, that puts to rest the issue of worrying about perpetuating an industry that is not interested in getting rid of Asian carp. We'd all love to get rid of Asian carp.
Any other questions? All right,
we can play that video if there's another question.
Yeah, we have a few videos, or just one that we'll try and play. The audio is a bit spotty, so we'll do our best on that. I'll also circulate these afterwards with the materials from the briefing. But this is a video that shows... I'm not sure which one he's using. What is the video?
This is got several different folks that are talking about these
All right, so we'll show this now and then we'll wrap up the briefing after that.
Thank you. 7 years ago. And what we thought was a problem then has turned into a mere tragedy today. The carrying capacity of a lake is the ability to hold X amount of fish. The problem that we have is the Asian carp is such a prolific breeder that it outgrows and outcompetes our native game fish, that there are getting to be the higher percentages of the population in Kentucky Market Lake, the entire Tennessee River, in anything that touches the Mississippi River.
They fill the same water that our fish are native games in, the same water that our lake supply. They fill it.
So that goes on for another 10 minutes. Cut it off there and we take more questions. If there's more questions, we can provide the link to YouTube videos. We can provide the link across the possible thing.
Yeah, I'll follow up with, like I said, the slides and audio recording and briefing, and I'll make sure the videos are included as well. And with that, I'll have one more call for question before we close it up. Any last takers?
So, can you repeat that, Matt? What's it?
Just wondering what kind of research we've done on the lifespan of fish, especially spawning. The video talked about these fish are out spawning other native sports fish. I know USGS is probably thinking of leaving the federal side of things, but I don't know. The states have been working with different universities on that research and those technologies to try to control.
Anybody want to speak to the research or reproduction?
The question is that reproduction?
I think so. In Minnesota, our universities aren't necessarily research and reproduction, but the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities has, with a lot of state funding support, looked into barrier technologies, specifically acoustic technology, and they're working, as Ron alluded to earlier, with the test system down in Kentucky. Our other universities have focused on habitat suitability in Minnesota and site feasibility for preventing fish from moving up into the state.
So these are one of the most, or two of the most studied species in the world. China has been studying these for hundreds, if not thousands of years. We took the USGS, Dwayne Chapman, he's probably the foremost expert when it comes to life cycles of these things. We know where they have to spawn to be have a successful recruitment class. They have to go up into running water somewhere. That running water has to persist for miles because these things will broadcast spawn their eggs. Their eggs need to not go down to the bottom where there's no oxygen and suffocate. So they have to be moving long enough to allow those eggs to hatch. So we know that much, and we've been doing telemetry projects to try and look and try and determine at what point and where, what tributaries they're using to try to do their spawning runs. Usually what happens is when there's an increase in water levels and discharges in the tributaries, that's a signal for Asian carp to try to go spawn. The unique thing about these fish that makes them even more prolific than our normal species, our regular species, is that they'll spawn multiple times a year. They'll take advantage of multiple high discharge periods. Every time there's a high discharge, that tells them, let's go spawn. And so we try to equate that data with the telemetry data, with the movement data, to try and figure out when we can get more easily at those fish in those tributaries. So we're using that part of their life cycle against them, you might say. So as far as being studied and the life cycles being studied, it's very, very well studied.
So just to add to what folks have said so far, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot more attention paid to kind of the presence and absence and distribution of young Asian carps, both, you know, juveniles, eggs, larvae, that several agencies, state agencies, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Service have been involved in. You know, say, I don't know, 7-10 years ago, we were looking for adults, we were using eDNA, we were looking for kind of these leading edges, and that's all really, really critical information. But then kind of the next evolution is, where are the young ones? So the last couple of years, that's really been a point of emphasis for state partners, for the Fish and Wildlife Service, but also for USGS. And I know we've got Cindy here from USGS. They've done a lot of modeling and Ron was talking about that a little bit, you know, looking at, you know, where, you know, what kind of conditions do they need for these eggs to survive and what kind of spawning conditions do the fish need, and USGS has been doing a lot of that work. Cindy, I don't know if you wanted to chime in a little bit or not. I don't want to put, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but
So yes, I'm Cindy Kolar with USGS, and I run the invasive species program there. We've been working on Asian carp for a long time. A lot of the life history work that we first did was to kind of compare life history from where they're native and where they've spread earlier to how they're behaving in the U.S. I think folks have kind of summed up a lot of what we've done, but figuring out where the conditions are right for these fish to spawn there's a lot of effort has been put there to understand the risk into new areas. And I think that was mostly what was talked about there. And we put a lot of work into developing molecular tools and improving those tools to look for those leading edges and working with Fish and Wildlife Service and state partners primarily.
The other thing I would add to that, Nick, you want to cover?
As part of the UMR framework, we have projects going on with both telemetry, similar to Ohio, and larval trapping. And the states of Illinois and Iowa are the leads on that. And a couple of things that we're discovering is that they use tributaries, but also that not every year is a successful year. They may attempt to spawn every year, but the young may not necessarily survive. And we're starting to see that you'll get a year every, Kevin can probably speak more, once every 5 years, approximately, they'll pull off a year class that can survive past the first year. Do you have anything to add?
I agree with that. We have not seen any other fish above Long Dam 19 this year. So there is some good news.
All right, we have time for maybe one more question. Any takers? All right. You, sir.
I can speak to that, and I think Ron may as well. So my position is the micro coordinator working with the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association. That's a partnership of all 28 states in the basin. And MICRA has been working with the Missouri River Basin states and the lower Mississippi River Basin states to pull together frameworks. So they have frameworks in place, and those multi-agency partnerships are working together to kind of organize their plans, their cooperative plans to address the species in both those locations, and they're moving forward with their projects, their priority needs as best they can with the state resources that they have. And Ron, I'll turn it over to you to add more.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that we've been trying to talk to folks in this city about since 2011, is funding for the national plan. The difference between now and then, though, is that we've had a lot of time to not only become familiar with a lot of you folks, but also we've been educated ourselves in terms of actually getting on the ball and getting ready when that funding comes. And that's what Greg was talking about as far as these frameworks that are being put together. If that $25 million that would take for that national plan to be implemented across the Mississippi River Basin was appropriated, I think I could tell you pretty confidently that every sub-basin in the Mississippi River would be ready to take that and put it to work the way it should be, not haphazardly, very, very well structured. That's number one. Number two, we recently asked Representative Comer to consider a $5 million for 5 years grant for the Tennessee-Cumberland River system. And basically, that ask was not for Kentucky. That ask was for Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Alabama. And so we were planning, if that funding were to come through, we were planning on jump-starting the framework in that area, but also doing what we needed to do with the commercial industry to get something in place that would keep these fish from to making it to Guntersville. And so that was what the ask was for. I don't know where that is today, but we are very, very attuned in the fact that these southern states have not received anything for their problems. And believe me, they've been part of the delegations that's gone to D.C. almost every year. They've led the charge as much as some of us that's gone almost every year, too. So I would really hope that if you guys walk away with nothing else today, you understand the enormity of the problem and the fact that it needs to be addressed holistically. And allow us to use that national management plan, and I think you'll see a lot of at least some kind of progress in keeping these things from important waters that they're still not in. There's still an awful lot of water out there where they haven't reached. Between that and the commercial industry fishing them down in areas just below those leading edges, we can actually get control in some areas, not the Mississippi River itself, but in some of the tributaries where we have control ability to keep those things from migrating further and then fishing them down above those points.
All right. With that, we will conclude our briefing. I want to thank you all again for coming. And like I said, we'll be passing the materials out. We'll send them out to you via email. And if you have any questions, I'm sure the speakers will be happy to come and talk with you personally afterwards. And thanks again. Have a great day.
Stick around.